Joel Pollack, as I said, says that South Africa is bringing the wrong attitude to Washington. He joins us this morning. Joel, a very good morning to you. How are you?
Good evening. We're still on Sunday night over here.
Yeah, I can tell you Monday's looking good. It's a beautiful day. So you've got something to look forward to.
Did the sun rise again? Like
it did. It did. And we always seem surprised because we think the news is so big it's not going to, but yet it does. So, Joel, it's really interesting because there's some very they're very real issues that the U.S. has, or real concerns that the U.S. has with what is happening in South Africa. But yet South Africa is very much caught up in this. Is this a genocide? Are they refugees? Do they look like refugees, etc.? Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I think there's generally a reluctance to acknowledge the severity of what's happened in South Africa over the last 30 years, or really, you could say the last 15 or so, because I think the first decade of the South African experiment began very optimistically. But I think the problem with terms like genocide is they get thrown around as South Africa likes to throw them around at Israel, and they're very emotive, but sometimes they're not quite anchored in reality. So I think what is fair to say is that South Africa is in a position that makes it vulnerable to such accusations because it is imposing racial discrimination on particular groups of people across a wide variety of industries in many areas of life, including in sports. And it's also now passed and signed into law the Expropriation Act, which allows property to be taken without compensation.
Right.
You add to that the Bella Act and the sense among Afrikaners in particular that their language is being suppressed. And you also throw in Julius Malema with his absurd rantings, which even in the United States, which has very broad protections for freedom of speech, would probably get him arrested for incitement. You have a picture that's quite concerning where, if you look several years down the line, you could almost see yourself saying, well, why didn't we stop it then before it became truly violent? So I think the world is reacting to those signs, and they are warning signs. That doesn't mean a genocide is happening. I don't think we're there yet, but these are the conditions in which one could happen, and I think people are concerned, and it has developed over time. And the current leadership of South Africa doesn't seem to want to do very much about it other than talk about how Trump is misinformed. That's not going to help. It's not going to help U.S.-South Africa relations, and it's not going to help South Africa.
Right. It's because it really is just a diversion away from maybe some of the more difficult subjects, which is actually a very much part and parcel of South Africa. One of the challenges that we have is we rushed very quickly and magnificently to the Rainbow Nation, but we didn't have some of the very hard conversations that we needed to have at the time. Maybe as a result of that, we find ourselves doing so now, or still trying to avoid it. With all of that, though, and you list a number of things, 5 points that are important, which is the Expropriation Act, racial quotas for employment, is hate speech, the ICJ case, and cooperation with Iran, and those five points are probably not probably those are key to the differences. Realistically, in a conversation that is going to take place at the White House on Wednesday, how much resolution can we really expect to achieve for all or any of these five?
None, I would think. I don't think there's any resolution coming. Because when you look at what Ramaphosa has been saying the last several days, where he's gone back to this idea that Trump's policy is fueled by misinformation, and he is accusing the Afrikaner refugees of being cowards. And by the way, it's not just 49. I mean, those are the 49 first people to come over, but there are 70,000 who've applied. And when you have John Steenhuisen, who I have a great degree of respect for as a leader of the Democratic Alliance, but when you have him taking virtually the same line, then you start to realize that the South African mission isn't really coming with any intention to compromise on anything, and you need compromise to reach an agreement. So what I think their strategy is playing out to be is to go to the United States and to show the South African media that they stood up to the big bully in the White House, but not actually to achieve anything concrete for South Africa or for relations with the United States. That appears to be their strategy. And I do think they're going to try to enlist the help of the media in Washington, both the American media and the international media, which never misses an opportunity to accuse Trump of racism. Mm. So you can almost imagine the press conference where Trump is confronted by several journalists about the accusation of genocide. They'll focus on that because he's used the term, and Trump likes to use terms to get people's attention. So they'll focus on that, and they'll challenge him, and Ramaphosa will stand there and look statesmanlike while Trump gets hit with questions, and Ramaphosa will report back to the South African public and say, you see, I tried to reason with him and I put our case as best I could, but you can see how the journalists treated him. They obviously don't take him very seriously, and therefore we don't need to listen to him at all. Mm. And nothing will be resolved, and the policy that Trump has begun will remain in place, in which South Africa is cut off from aid and where there really is no progress on trade relations. And I think that's actually their strategy. I think that the government of national unity, including the Democratic Alliance, have become so nervous, I think, about the stability of their own government that they would prefer to score a win in the South African media than to score a policy success with the United States, because it would involve some compromises that various constituencies, particularly within the ANC, are not willing to tolerate. For example, the United States has asked that the South African government withdraw from the case against Israel at the United Nations International Court of Justice, which is going nowhere.
Mm, mm.
But South Africa refuses.
But costing South Africa its reputation and millions.
Mm. Yeah, and South Africa refuses because it's beholden to a small radical Islamist constituency that has a great deal of influence within the South African media and within the ruling party and Durko and so forth. So it may be that Cyril Ramaphosa is just too weak to get anything done on a policy level, but he's very good at knowing how to play the media game. And so I think that's their strategy. I don't think it's going to work, because I think that you'll find there are more diverse views in the American media than perhaps Ramaphosa realizes. This is not the same White House. It's not the same White House press corps. And there are going to be some tough questions. He's going to have to explain some of his own policies. He's going to have to explain why he signed the Expropriation Act. He may even have to explain why the ANC's coffers were suddenly filled after Naledi Pandor took a trip to Iran.
And in fact, he hasn't answered that question locally.
Yeah. So I know there are people who are going to ask him some tough questions. And so I don't think this idea that you can simply corner Trump with a sympathetic media is going to work. It'll work to some extent. But I think that ultimately, if you're looking at the substance, or as they used to say in the 1980s, where's the beef? I don't anticipate him coming back with very much, because he's not offering anything.
And there has to be some form of recognition that the policies have failed. We've had another increase in unemployment. We're the highest youth unemployment in the world, more than 8 million people unemployed in South Africa. Clearly, it's not working. The people aren't leaving because they are happy. They're leaving because they're enormously, enormously frustrated. So no matter what he says and no matter how he tries to portray the so-called misinformation, and whether it is or isn't is irrelevant, the reality is that on the ground, South Africa is not thriving, and it's not thriving as a result largely of these policies. So that's my concern, is when you start going down this misinformation and how dare they call us names, then you move away from the substantive issues. The truth is, I do love the irony of South Africa being accused of genocide, whether it's appropriate or not. I don't particularly think so, but it doesn't matter. I just love the fact that South Africa is being accused of it, given that they the leaders in Israel apartheid and Israel genocide. So there's a certain amount of irony in that, but that's just an empty win, isn't it?
I don't know if it's empty, because it is possible that the United States could take action against South Africa, whether international sanctions or even taking South Africa to the the International Court of Justice. I mean, if you don't want to call Afrikaners refugees, where are the Afrikaners supposed to go? Their own judicial system has refused to take up the question of whether Julius Malema's chanting "kill the Boer, kill the farmer, shoot to kill," whether that's hate speech under South African law. If they refuse to take it up and to interfere with that, then the only recourse for South Africans who are troubled by that kind of speech is the International Court of Justice. And South Africa also has obligations under the Genocide Convention, and I would argue that South Africa is in violation of those. So South Africa is actually vulnerable to the same kind of challenge brought against Israel, but with far greater merit against South Africa than Israel, because unlike Israel, South Africa wasn't attacked by an army of marauding terrorists intent on killing every civilian they could find. So I think, look, you mentioned the economic picture and unemployment. There's a striking interview that has come out in the last few days in which there's a spokesperson for the African National Congress who was asked point blank what she would tell investors who don't like the policies. And she says, well, they should go somewhere else.
Yeah, go to India.
And that's what they're doing. Go to India. That's what they're doing. But that sort of attitude is extraordinary. You know, a business doesn't survive if it tells customers to go to the competitor down the street. You know, you have to adopt the approach that the customer is always right, and you have to change what you're doing to attract customers. And the ANC seems to think it's entitled to someone else's wealth, whether it's the wealth of other South Africans or the wealth of the rest of the world, or perhaps, as may be the case, the wealth of wealthy patrons in countries that are hostile to the United States and that don't mind doing business with the ANC in that fashion. But it's not going to work for the most for most South Africans. It hasn't generated economic growth, and it doesn't attract investment of the kind that could create broad-based employment and true economic empowerment. So I don't expect much, actually, from the rhetoric of South Africa's leaders. There have been some in that delegation who perhaps have been more pragmatic, but Ramaphosa is going to be center stage. And you mentioned a token. You know, Steenhuisen risks being window dressing. He's kind of the living white exhibit that there's no white genocide, almost kind of like Sarah Bartman. Sarah Bartman sort of being carted around, like, you know, here's our white African.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the risk he runs, because he hasn't really established an independent voice as to what he expects on this trip. We did hear some independence from a DA delegation that came a few months ago, but as far as his role in this delegation, it doesn't seem to be any different from the ANC's line at all.